For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. With me in the cave, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to be dealing with, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. We have a special guest here today who's going to help us kind of address an interesting situation. We're in that kind of that end time for the election this year. The Catholic vote, quote unquote, seems to be split. It doesn't really seem to be a cohesive group like most people would assume it is. Where does that take us? How did we get where we are today? Tim, I'll have you introduce our guest.
Okay, well, it's my pleasure to introduce Richard Reinsch. He is an author and also fellow at the Liberty Fund here in Indianapolis. Welcome to the Catholic Cave.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Now, we're going to do a few things today. First, we're going to find out a little bit about you. I know you've got a new book out. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the mission at Liberty Fund. And we're also going to do something we've never done here before, which is we're going to dust off a great Catholic thinker called Orestes Brownson, which I know you're a scholar of. That's the subject of your new book. And so we're going to talk about that and why we should care about him. But first, Richard Reinsch, great to have you here. At last, another Irishman in the Catholic cave. I think you're German like Tuttle over here. He's always pulling out Hegel and
got to represent
Heidegger. You know, he's just on and on and on. And Kant, those are his three guys. So watch out.
Yeah. Well, those are great Catholic thinkers, though.
So. Yeah, that's true. It's true. Yeah, we could do a whole show on the Catholicity of Heidegger sometime. But we try to keep our listeners awake, so we might pass on that one.
That's right. And I know you do podcasts too. But so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I work for Liberty Fund here in Indianapolis. I moved here to work for Liberty Fund. I'm a trained lawyer. Before I was at Liberty Fund or came to Liberty Fund, I did mergers and acquisitions and securities law.
Great.
Didn't want to do that. Wanted to do something much more related to ideas, to writing.
Know the feeling.
and research along those lines. And this position at Liberty Fund opened itself to me. And so, long story short, that's why I'm here. Liberty Fund itself, the mission is very unique. It's one of the more unique institutions or foundations in America. The founder, Pierre Goodrich, from Richmond, Indiana, probably one of the wealthiest men that Indiana has produced, very much believed in education around great books. But I don't mean that in necessarily a formulaic sense that we tend to think of there's a canon and you should study it. And we have colleges, you know, Catholic colleges like Thomas Aquinas in California that pursue that. But he very much believed, and you know, he founds Liberty Fund in 1960, that amidst the sort of creeping collectivization in the liberal democracies, also totalitarianism and communism, that the way to think about this was to actually go back and read great thinkers in the Western tradition, also in other traditions as well, along the lines of politics, economics, law, theology, and ask them what they reveal to us about the nature of freedom and responsibility.
Yeah, because I think we get in this rut where we think that all of these sort of new threats to freedom, new threats to culture, we think of them as new, and there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, these have been threats that have been there really since the dawn of civilization. And so, yeah, you're right. A great antidote to that is to go back and look at people who've confronted these problems in their own day.
That's right. That's right. And to think about also, you know, you don't want to just be caught up in policy-driven responses or ideological formulaic responses. And that's what opens to you. What books are you reading? What questions are you asking? What periods are you studying? And that sort of, you know, informs you and gives you a way to think about your current situation as you were discussing. And there's also something just, you know, that you know, there is truth. And that we can discover.
Whoa, wait a minute. However, it's been a hot topic there.
Right. However imperfectly we might know it, that in, you know, conscience, to know with others, to do this education and study and conversation with others is, you know, very much a part of what Liberty Fund is about.
That's fantastic. And so I think, tell us, so how does Liberty Fund go about sort of accomplishing this mission of education?
Well, our, you know, just thinking about our program, so we do close to 100 conferences a year with academics all over the world. And, you know, increasingly we're doing them in Hong Kong and in India, which is really interesting. And so those are very much Socratic discussions of, you know, 15 people around a table, who all of whom have read, you know, the same books beforehand, and just discuss them with sort of a light traffic cop type, you know, discussion leader. And, you know, the conversation can go anywhere, and who knows. And so that's a huge part of what we do. We also do that type of format with a lot of other people besides academics, also, you know, with college students, with lawyers, with professionals, high school teachers. We're really involved with the American founding and free markets with high school teachers. Huge part of what we do, trying to sort of, you know, combat this sort of, you know, most of our teachers come out of progressive teacher colleges where they really learn very little. But they learn sort of like the way to teach, but they don't know what they're teaching. And so we're actually trying to give them the bulk of our tradition in these conferences, the bulk of our political and economic tradition. Besides that, then what I do for Liberty Fund is something is our web program. And so I founded 4 years ago Law and Liberty at libertylawsite.org. And, you know, what you will see there is high-powered legal academics, political scientists, public intellectuals writing on all manner of books, of policy, current debates. But what I think we do well and in our specialty is we bring to bear deep foundational philosophical learning to contemporary questions. So that in a nutshell, and then our publishing program, which is most people know us through our publishing program. I think wonderful books at very affordable prices. Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, The Federalist Papers.
De Tocqueville.
De Tocqueville's Democracy in America. So that also is a huge part of what we do. And, you know, the idea there is we are keeping alive the best that's been said about liberty and responsibility.
Well, and I've been the recipient of some of those books and purchased them as well. And I'll tell you what I like about it is that a lot of these books you're retrieving and making new. And my one, if I have an addiction, it's to books. So I got a lot of books.
It's a good addiction.
Yeah. It is. And Liberty Fund, when you're not only making them accessible to make sure that they're not going out of print, but you also keep the costs really low too.
That's right.
So you can get, for example, de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, beautiful 2-volume set, and it's inexpensive. It's like $30, you know, and it, you would normally, that'd be an $80, $90, $100 set of volumes if you were to kind of pay full retail. So that's fantastic. So we're delighted that you're here because here on the Catholic Cave, we're interested in the Catholic philosophical tradition and philosophy even more broadly. So this is a great format. Let's talk a little bit maybe about the subject of your new book, which is called Seeking the Truth. And you heard me kind of react a little bit when you said the truth, because we're kind of in this, I think we're in a the kind of cultural crisis where there's a ton of skepticism around whether what the truth is or if the truth even exists. And so this title of the book, Seeking the Truth, an Orestes Brownson anthology, seems like perfect topic for us to kind of unpack this idea. So when you say seeking the truth, what do you mean by the truth?
Well,
does it exist?
Yeah, no, the truth with regard to Orestes Brownson, we're seeing a man who, by the way, unjustly neglected, greatest Catholic thinker America has produced. And in particular, with regards to the Constitution and thinking about the rule of law and also the way he would investigate history, there's really the only comparable figure I can think of is John Courtney Murray, who in the 20th century and, you know, the author of the Religious Freedom Document in Vatican II, largely attributed to him. So, and then Murray parallels Orestes Brownson in many ways, although he never cites to him. So I think there's some sort of current of an American Catholic tradition that is open to our constitutional tradition. But keep in mind, for Orestes Brownson, seeking the truth was, the idea that there is a reality, there is an external world, and our mind has access to it. And so keep in mind, what does modern philosophy say? We only have access to reality through images or through representations of it. That our mind can form, and so it's incredibly subjective. And then, you know, what you see with modern philosophy, speaking very broadly here, is sort of the long road to skepticism, the long road to the philosophic relativism that we live in now. And Orestes Bronson rejects this, and he rejects this in several crucial ways. But I think maybe the most important way for this program is he has this idea of the freedom of God, and so Bronson is coming out of, he's a Catholic convert, and he's coming out of a very radical, progressive, Protestant, individualistic way of thinking. And he
even existed back then?
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if we ever moved out of it then.
Right. Well, no, and I mean, that's a discussion we've had on this show before, is sort of what is the native philosophy of the American project, you know? And I think we get a distorted view to a certain extent because of the influence of people like Orestes Bronson and other Catholics who've come along, that we think of this country as a lot more Catholic than it really was at its roots. And so sort of the root thought going forward from the founding was very Protestant and very individualistic. And and this is an ongoing debate that Tim and I have had here as to what extent have we changed from the original project, or to what extent was the idea of America and the founding principles, those were completely compatible with Catholic thought and Catholicism.
Well, I think what Orestes Bronson, you know, he has this idea. He writes a book in 1865, and he says, this is the most mature statement of my thought. At the end of the Civil War that took two of his sons from him, one was a prisoner of war for a long time, and Orestes Bronson is saying, we're an immature country, and we've been led into this crisis because we can only think about our constitutional tradition in the light of social contract thought. But he says, but that's not our only tradition. Actually, what we have to keep in mind is the written constitution is always premised on a deeper unwritten constitution. And so if we take the full weight of Western political thought, history, religion, and the learning that delivered to the founders, they may not have understood it themselves to be doing that in their own terms, but they can't finally remove themselves from who we are as Westerners. And in that sense, there's a deep connection between the American constitutional tradition and going back to, say, the medieval constitution of England, that they're sort of realizing, you know, the thing, and they do think of themselves as recovering that English constitution in their own act of revolution, in the sense of the rule of law. There's an idea of representation there that had been, they thought, lost by the British Empire that they were rebelling against. So for Bronson, it's not so much that America is ignoring sort of the deep currents of Catholic thought. It's that they don't fully understand what they were doing in an act of founding. They understood it through John Locke explicitly, but there's something much more fundamental under the surface that can be uncovered.
So there's kind of two traditions that are kind of getting, I think, fleshed out here. So we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about these sort of two traditions of the American founding.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blandford, and we have a special guest in our office, Mr. Richard Reinsch, from the Liberty Fund, and we are talking about one of the most influential Catholic thinkers that nobody knows about, Orestes Bronson. And so right before the break, we were kind of talking about how at the American founding, we were all familiar with the Enlightenment tradition, that, you know, we get our ideas from the Enlightenment, etc. But there's almost a second hidden tradition that America was founded on that has its roots back in sort of the medieval English medieval English church and the tension there, I think, that arose between Catholicism and Protestantism has sort of flavored the way things go. And so Orestes Bronson was a thinker that he was a convert and had a pretty deep conversion. And so he, I think, wrestled with this tension between Protestant intellectual thought and Catholic intellectual thought and those two traditions and how they played out in America, probably more than any other thinker. Mm-hmm. A little bit about Orestes Bronson and his life. What was it in his life that allowed him to I think, be able to take this almost sort of unique set of problems and wrestle with them?
Well, I think what we can't forget with Bronson, he's born in Vermont, but largely grows up in upstate New York. So if you're aware of sort of the roiling, religious ferment in America at that time in the very early 19th century, you know, this part was called the Burned Over District precisely because there's so many revivals in the area and so many new sort of Protestant sects coming out of that, including, the Church of Latter-day Saints. Comes out of this area. Bronson actually knew Joseph Smith somewhat. I don't think they had a deep friendship, but they knew one another. So you can't divorce this aspect of Bronson. There is this sort of questioning and wondering what's happening. Early Presbyterian, then moves into Unitarianism, Universalism, mm-hmm. Atheism. Underneath it all, though, is a sort of a Protestant liberation theological project. Now, that would be our term. He wouldn't use that term, right. But he very much understood Christological symbols in a revolutionary format. Religion should be used for social reform, and this is someone who is profoundly invested that the Declaration of Independence and American constitutionalism means egalitarianism and equal outcomes and rights in that respect.
Right, because at the same time, same place, I mean, he's living pretty close with Henry David Thoreau, with Emerson, with some of those types of things.
Well, Bronson was a transcendentalist and knew these guys very well. I think what he brought, most of the transcendentalists are rooted in German thought in America.
Oh, there you go, Mark.
And he brought a French perspective. What's interesting, though, in Bronson's transcendentalist thought is he starts to think about this sort of the way Emerson and Thoreau write, you're kind of like you want to sink down into your nature. And Bronson starts to realize, wow, this involves a sort of individualism writ large that that could really get out of control and completely dismisses human reason. And the idea that we are actually discovering something apart from ourselves with other people, this sort of sinking within to find your true inner self. Bronson clearly gets that's not going to work out
so
well.
That's going to be a
problem. Right. And this is sort of the beginning. This is the beginnings for him of moving out of transcendentalism and also moving out of the more radical thinking in his life. And he starts to, we might say, I would say a moderate turn. What's interesting is, the modern conceit is the less religious you are and the more you move into skeptical thinking or atheistic thinking, the more reasonable you become, the less dangerous you are. And that's the way our politics should be, right? And that's right. The way our universities and
that's
education.
That's conventional wisdom.
And Bronson, Bronson's really the exact opposite. The more open he is to Trinitarianism, the more he moves into belief in God, accepting the Bible on its own terms instead of using it for a political project, the more he's able actually to defend our Republican Constitution. And he starts to locate, actually, Republican constitutionalism, liberal democracy, its best framework and defense is actually within the Jewish Christian tradition and anthropology and the metaphysics and all of that. And he starts to locate it in a piece. That's why we have, ultimately, in a nutshell, that's why we have to keep Bronson, studying Bronson, thinking about him and all of that.
So can you, would it be fair to kind of compare him back to what St. Augustine was doing in the Roman Empire with the City of God, kind of writing an apologia for Christianity and for Catholicism and making the claim that, sort of the authentic expression of the American project comes out through Catholicism best?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to compare what Augustine's doing too quickly. But no, I see the broad outline there. I think for Bronson, it's not so much. De Tocqueville says, either Americans will lose their religion or they'll all become Catholic. And what he means by that is, there's so much religious potentiality within America that it'll probably fall apart.
That's the one quote I read out of this morning.
Now, Bronson also thinks that America is going to become Catholic. Now, we can kind of laugh at that now.
If it's sustainable, it's going to be Catholic. And now I think we're seeing it doesn't look like it's going to be Catholic. Yeah. And I'm not sure if the American project is going to be sustainable.
We have no clue. We have no clue. So with that regard, with the American Republic, 1865, what he's trying to do there is provide a very deep philosophical defense of constitutionalism beyond just the Enlightenment conceit that we can create it and build it around self-interest, property rights, a wide understanding of individual liberty. You know, what really makes that book worth reading in another respect is loyalty. And how does a classical liberal account inspire people to be loyal to it if everything is a self-interest calculation? Where do the deep reserves of loyalty come from? What makes people defend a free society? And that's when you start to bring in these ideas that, you know, your character and your virtue are formed within a certain political order, and you recognize that, and you see your family in that, and you see your faith in that, and that inspires devotion. And this is just sort of lost, he thinks, in a court of, you know, clockwork framework of, you know, it's all formal.
A calculus,
et cetera. Yeah.
The mathematization that we have these days of, say, morality.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Very utilitarian.
Yeah, and that's probably more important now to a certain extent than it was even in Bronson's day. I mean, I think we've got this idea that the ideal world is sort of this global metropolis where we all kind of, you know, our houses are pretty much like airports and we just fly from place to place and we can relocate from place to place. And therefore there's no loyalty to hearth and home. There's no loyalty to your people.
Well, there's no accounting of love.
And
right.
Well,
I mean, ultimately as Catholics, that's what we're, the highest order is love.
Now, hearing that, I mean, this is one of the things that Bronson talks about is because our purpose is beyond history, it's beyond this world. The only way we can access it is through our particular loves and loyalties, because that's, you know, that is who we are. We are finite. We are limited by time and place and settlement and family. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to approach it through that. And if you dismiss that framework, then probably what you get is a lot of people slumbering around the world. You get a lot of nations that don't understand themselves or their purposes anymore. And so you get sort of a sort of chaos. Or, you know, you think about this idea of the last man democratic syndrome where, you know, as you know, who wrote about that very well? Alan Bloom in The Closing of the American Mind.
Right, right.
We don't really care about anything anymore. And so that's sort of kind of, you know, what Bronson is starting to, you know, what he's trying to lay out for people is, you know, this loyalty and connection is a deep part of what it means to be a human being. And so this, you know, we're not liberal individuals. We're relational persons. We're formed by our relationships. We're constituted by them. And that's what a constitutional order protects.
Let me ask you about this. So listeners, we're in the cave. We're with author and fellow at the Liberty Fund, Richard Reinsch. We're talking about and I agree with this, it's provocative, the most influential Catholic thinker of the 19th century, who's really been lost to us, right? Orestes Brownson. Tell me a little bit, I read about his background. So for our listeners, tell us about his sort of intellectual biography, if you would. I was really surprised by his formal education, or lack thereof.
Lack thereof. No, you know, and just a note,
because he is a great thinker, and yet
he's an incredible thinker. No, and just one quick note. You say Orestes Brownson has been lost to us. In many respects, I think it mirrors sort of the arc of the Catholic Church in America over the last 50 years. You know, we were talking about before the program, first 50 years in America, Bronson's the subject of over 40 dissertations.
Yeah, so 40, through the 1950s.
So
right?
that's basically 50 book-length studies by young graduate students. What do you write your dissertation on? What inspires you? I mean, you know, what do you want to invest in as your first major project? Bronson was it. Bronson was also incredibly important for Russell Kirk, probably the most significant American conservative writer, period. And so we shouldn't, you know, he's not lost to us. I think we made ourselves perhaps lose him by
we've set him aside.
By getting caught up in, you know, Catholic intellectual life in America has been very thin, frankly, for a while now. And so we're not even punching our own weight class. So that's just a brief moment there. Bronson's his intellectual life is, you know, think about Arthur Schlesinger Jr. All right, so the court historian of the New Deal, whose entire historical project was to locate America in sort of a progressive political ideology and to show that part of our country and he sees everything in this light. And Orestes Bronson was the subject of his master's thesis at Harvard, precisely because Bronson is so radical and so left-wing in the 1820s and 1830s. And as Schlesinger says, he's saying things Karl Marx says in the 1840s, 20 years earlier, and he's an American without an education who grows up in upstate New York and basically this frontier. Where does this come from? And so for Bronson, we have to keep in mind also all the potentialities within the American political tradition. And one of those is, I think, a progressive tradition. Bronson comes out of that, though. Two things happen to him. So we talk about lack of a formal education. He's an autodidact. He can remember everything that he reads. And this was pretty evident in his early childhood. I mean, just his incredible mind. He studied 12 hours a day. He would unwind by playing chess with one of his sons. This was a man who would be a premier public intellectual in our day. Of course, you know, in his day, you lived by a patron if you didn't have a formal institutional home, and he didn't. So he edited a journal. He made subscription money off of that, and then he was supported by various wealthy people to go speak and write all over the country. But what brings Bronson out of that? He is sort of the court philosopher of the Democratic Party as a progressive. And he sees democracy leading to what he thinks are unbound outcomes. And the 1840 election is huge for Bronson. And he pays a price because he's very radical. And the Whigs pin him on the Democrats. They tie each other together. And Bronson, what he sees from that is, it's not the case that the people are going to always give us the best outcome. What do the people know? And so this is humility. This is a humility. This is a learning about problems with majoritarian democracy. And also he comes to believe in this idea of the freedom of God, which I think you can see a part of this in the incredibly important encyclical by Pope Benedict XVI on charity. And what Bronson had really sort of limited God or thought of God more in a deist formulation, even though he's a Protestant. And in that respect, when he starts to think about the freedom of God, what he understands is God is not limited. He is everywhere a part of my being. I am dependent upon him. And leads him to think in new ways about love, about community, about relationality of human beings. And that sort of sets him on his way, and then starts reading theology all over again, begins his education again, starts reading Aristotle, starts reading the Scholastics, and then 1844, he becomes Roman Catholic.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll learn a little bit more about this great conversion, and we'll go back a little bit to this idea of the freedom of God.
Three things keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air. One is our fervent desire to spread the gospel message. Two is your donations to the station. We couldn't survive without them. And three is underwriting from area businesses. Every month, these businesses make donations to the station. Please support them. Visit their stores, send them an email, or call them. Let them know that you appreciate their support of Catholic Radio. It's a great way to thank our underwriters for their very important support.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell. And in here, we have Mark Tuttle, as usual, Kent Blanford, our trusty sidekick and producer, special guest, Richard Reinch of the Liberty Fund. And we are talking about a great Catholic thinker that you maybe have never heard about, and you need to know who this is. It's Orestes Bronson. And he lived in the 19th century. We're starting to unpack a little bit about his life, his impact on the church. Richard Reinch's new book is called Seeking the Truth, an Orestes Bronson anthology. Catholic University Press, I believe.
Catholic University Press.
Get it on Amazon.com. That's where I found it. I love it. You are going to love it, too. Now, Bronson, where we left off before the break, he converts to Catholicism. What sort of leads him into that? And then what follows from that conversion?
Well, I think what leads Bronson into this, he's a transcendentalist, he's a major thinker, and he starts to respond to Emerson. And Emerson gave a famous address at the Harvard Divinity School, which is basically seen now in retrospect as the first proclamation of the death of God in America.
Oh, boy.
By a major figure. It was a very important address at the time. And this has a huge impact on Bronson when he starts to think through it, and he thinks about, what is Emerson saying about God? What is he saying about man? What is he saying about our nature? What is he saying about our reason? What is he saying about what leads to a good life? And all of this Bronson in sort of a moment. And I mentioned the politics. The politics is important. And all of, I think all of this is there's a deep learning and a hunger for truth. And that's why I called it seeking the truth, because he's not satisfied with modern categories and modern terms. And he starts reading. He's willing to question what he's been doing. And I think it's important. We talked about his lack of formal education. He's never tied to any school, and that's important. He's never tied to any set of thinkers. He is always his own man, his own thinker. He just so happens to choose the church that is the most vilified in history for being so conformist, but that's where his questioning and reading and study lead him. We've talked some about the freedom of God. Another way to think about this is to walk into it through the way Pope Benedict talks about it, whereas Aristotle believes in God, but it's not a relational God. It's not a personal God. It's a what. It's not a who. And it's a what that is utterly unconcerned with your existence. And to the extent you get close to that God, you lose yourself. You lose who you are. For Bronson, this freedom of God, this is a personal, relational God that calls me as I am to love him. And when you consider that and you think about all of the implications that means for your human nature, for anthropology, for society, for the social order, the political order, what seem like things we have to invent, like politics, or we have to invent a way to do a market, or all of this, it's like these are artificial. We're doing, this is natural. Politics is a natural part of man. It comes out of our sociability, our relationality. So is family life. Education has to be understood in these terms. So he gets into an incredible debate with Horace Mann in Massachusetts. Horace Mann's the one who invents all these state departments of education run our children. Yeah. And he says, that's not education. It's not a formal way to make good democratic citizens who can labor in an economy. It's about truth. And this is why he defends local control, because actually if we take that seriously, we have to take into account the local ways the local settlements that people might have for that. So this is a part of Bronson's, both his commitment to America, but he is a friendly critic of America. We don't have all the answers explicitly, and to the extent we do, it's because we keep in mind the full scope of learning we've received in that interplay between Jerusalem and Athens and Rome, Edinburgh, all of these major cities that have contributed to the formation of the Western mind have to be kept in play and in discussion. Another part of Bronson's conversion, I think, too, is this idea that there is a final cause. There is a formal and final cause. And that's, what does that unlock? That unlocks meaning and purpose for everything we do and the way we think about ourselves. And so we're coming out of modernity, I think Bronson says, is sort of a confinement. It's a false confinement that
it's sort of collapsing in on ourselves.
That promises its own liberation, but really can't deliver the goods. And think about the way Bronson understands the Civil War. Who are the preeminent Lockeans, the preeminent followers of John Locke? Bronson says it's the Southerners. Right. Why is it the Southerners? Because the Southerners understand that if political order begins with consent, then who's the principal of the political order? The individual. So the individual can always walk away if he doesn't like it. And that's what the Southerners are doing. Now, they're saying the states are the principals, but the states on behalf of the slave owners don't like the bargain anymore, and they're leaving. And Bronson says, in a way, they had a point.
Right.
So and so that's why Bronson doesn't recommend harsh measures coming out of the Civil War, because it's a part of our tradition. And who threatened secession the most? It was actually the New England states before the Southerners, but that's an aside. So Bronson, so we have to rehabilitate and rethink the way we do Republican constitutionalism and recover what was lost. And that's this unwritten constitution and also territorial democracy, which is to say it's not just me and us creating ex nihilo a government, but there's a settlement. There's law.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point to make, that when we look at all the problems, and during political season when you got the candidates, that's where our minds naturally go. All of the problems that exist within our country, going back to the intellectual tradition that came out of Catholicism, particularly, because, like you said, you know, that's where his own conversion was led by trying to wrestle with these problems and looking back and kind of seeing, you know, Catholicism had laid the groundwork for the answers to these questions. That's a deep well that we can take as American Catholics, particularly, to the problems and political situations that we've got within our country today. Why does that not seem to be playing out? That would be my big question. What is it about America that doesn't allow us to kind of follow Bronson's example and sort of apply this great well of tradition to American life today?
Well, I mean, gosh, that's a whole other radio program. I think, you know, when you think about with Bronson, the way he approached particular political disputes is, so what do we have? So we have a Puritan tradition, we have sort of a free Protestant tradition, but then we do have Jefferson primarily would be the biggest representative. We have an Enlightenment, liberal, skeptical, progressive tradition. And so all of these things are going to be always working within American debates. How do you find the median? How do you find the meat? I mean, if you think about, you know, Bronson, immigration is a huge part of Bronson because as a convert to Roman Catholicism, he's looking at Irish immigrants and he's telling them, you know, you got to become Americans. You've got to become good defenders of the American Constitution. You keep your faith, obviously, but you will have to become Americans. And he spells out all of what that means. And he, you know, he gets criticized for that as being unfriendly to immigrants, but he's trying to deliver them over to the new country they've come to. You think about immigration situation here. I think Bronson would say we have two extremes. One extreme is open borders, and we have major interest in our country who favor that. The other extreme, and I think the Catholic bishops need to learn this. The other extreme is closed borders, and so the difference is somewhere in the median, and that's going to be a question not just of economics but also citizenship, and how are we going to bring in people that we need, inform them not just to be workers but also to be American citizens. And so that's sort of always working for Bronson, is there are extremes in politics that look promising, but actually the American tradition is to find something in the middle. And that is sort of a sort of Catholic skepticism that politics or economics is going to solve all your problems. It's not.
Right.
Yeah. What is it about Orestes Bronson's thinking that we might, so you're listening to the program right now, thinking, why should I pick up Orestes Bronson now, and how might he see the current setting that we're in? What value is there of going back to an Orestes Bronson, acquainting ourselves with some of his thought, and how might we apply that, or how might he see this? And those are kind of two related questions. And then how might he see the current setting that we're in? What would he make of it?
I wrote a paper that was published a few years ago. I talk about it some in the introduction. Bronson really anticipates the progressives, but the forerunner would be the abolitionist. And this is not, Bronson did not defend slavery in any way. But when he looked at the abolitionists, and then he looked at the Southerners, what he saw, again, two extremes. One group willing to eviscerate federalism, that was the abolitionist, and then coming out of the Civil War, really wanting to punish the South and really wanting to take away self-government, federalism, and have everything be very much run by Washington on a lot of questions. And then you had sort of the Southerners, and the Southerners refusing to acknowledge or bend to anything in Reconstruction that had been achieved through the war. And so Bronson, right there, you're seeing someone who is trying to find a way to defend what's good about our Constitution. The two, you know, the one aspect of that, federalism, and then you've also got separation of powers, the other part of our Constitution, is trying to show a way that we preserve that amidst pressing circumstances of parties who are literally at each other's throats, but through an ideology are forgetting what it is to be an American. Also, when you read the American Republic, you get this sense of a severe indictment of what is really the poverty of sort of the liberal individualism of our time and sort of the subjectivity of subjectivities that promises freedom, but that really delivers us over to collectivism. And Bronson understands this.
Patrick Deneen
I think is right there. Bronson understands things that, you know, later that thinkers in the 20th century start to learn. And so you think about right now, this, you know, we're thinking about the millennials, this huge generation that sort of after 2008, we all started thinking about them. Why? Because they seem to like socialism. They seem to be very secular. They are for all manner of the LGBTQ agenda. They have very light religious commitments. And I think when you read Bronson, so just trying to be very practical here, when you read Bronson, you can start to understand that group. On one hand, they want maximum individual freedom. On the other hand, they want big institutional responsibilities to be taken away from them and handled by the government. And that's what Bronson talks about. Individualism opens into a collectivism if it is not rooted in something higher or bound by an anchor of ethical thought and reflection.
Well, I want to touch on that point just a little bit. I know we're going to take a break here in just a minute. So why is it that radical individualism opens ourselves up to collectivism? What is it about the pursuit of that? Is it a rejection of responsibility? Because I remember St. John Paul the Great, his emphasis on freedom was never freedom in isolation. That is really kind of a results in a kind of enslavement. It's a kind of a trap for us. But freedom and responsibility, or think of his book, Love and Responsibility, right? Is it that divorce of freedom and responsibility in radical individualism that makes us susceptible to collectivism?
I think that's right. You know, another thinker who's very important in our tradition on this is Alexis de Tocqueville. We've mentioned him some, and he has this idea of democratic individualism. And what that is I so sink within myself. The only people I really know are immediate family and close friends, and I lose connection with the middle institutions or sort of a responsibility to things that are more important to me and that I serve because I'm so awash in the subjectivity that comes over me. And also, I become prey. I become prey to dominant forces and opinions because I lose the independent thought, reflection, and the way in which knowing things with others helps me overcome that. And so that, I think, the loss of responsibility and the will, and I just want walking. You know, you think about the millennials living in their parents' basement. Just give me some walking around money so I can have
right.
You know, marriage, children, houses, all these things. America
sounds like a lot of work.
Yep. Sounds boring. You know, Bronson, too.
Sounds overwhelming.
You know, Bronson, too, is important on the religious freedom question because what we've also seen painfully revealed to us is religious freedom can't just be an individualistic concept. We saw that with the contraception mandate and the way in which government can overwhelm the power of an institution to actually teach its own members what it believes and holds to be the truth. And Bronson understands this. He understands freedom of the church. Freedom of the church. Why? Because we do religious stuff with other people.
Well, let's hold that thought for just a second. We'll come back from our break and we'll talk a little bit more about religious freedom and what Orestes Bronson has to teach us today.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we have a special guest with us, Richard Reinsch, and we're talking about Orestes Bronson, a great Catholic thinker, mid 19th century, and we were just talking about the concept of religious freedom. You had brought up the idea of the freedom of God, but also more importantly, this idea of religious freedom being an intricate part of America that Orestes Bronson had a lot to say about the current debates going on right now around religious freedom.
And also, the idea that Bronson locates through his Catholic conversion is the church is something people do together with others. And so you have to understand this as a corporate freedom. And that is actually the better grounding, he thinks, for religious freedom in America, other than it being a purely individual pursuit. You keep in mind, you know, some of the biggest defenses of religious freedom that we talk about today, James Madison, Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, which is, you know, when you read that, it's purely the individual alone figuring out God or figuring out his or her duties to God. And this is an abstraction. Now, Bronson doesn't address that directly, or Thomas Jefferson in the Virginia defense, thinking about the mind has been created free, which is a good starting point. God has created the mind free. For Bronson, there's something corporate, there's thick, there's relational, and the Catholic Church in America, he says, there is no country in the world that has been more friendly to the Catholic Church than the United States of America. So he says, we don't just have religious toleration. We value religion as a positive good in and of itself. And so the Catholic Church has all that it needs. And he tells the story of, I think it was a European bishop on behalf of somebody wanting to set up a Catholic diocese in America. And contacting an official in Washington, I'm blanking on the particulars. What do we need to do? And the response is nothing. You just do it. And, Bronson's like, wow, this is the America, that the religious freedom concept that we have to defend. So this is, it's positive, it's corporate, and we're seeing this play out right now.
Right.
I think, yeah.
Because that's the terms of the debate that have been laid out right now. You heard a lot of the term freedom of worship, that religious freedom really boils down to freedom of worship, which means you have the freedom to go to your house of worship, to go there on Sunday to worship, but as far as bringing any of your beliefs, your way of life, what your religion brings into the public square, that's going too far, and that's crossing the bounds and trying to impose your religion on other people.
It's like they're suggesting we're limited to, like, quiet moments of self-expression,
right,
behind closed doors.
Exactly.
But then just sort of keep that to yourself.
Yeah, but what you were saying about Bronson is that he kind of sees that dichotomy between, okay, if religious freedom is this sort of individual freedom, it's not going to work out well. Mm-hmm. That we have to protect the corporate freedom to be able to worship as a religion as a whole, not just as individuals.
And to be able to speak to the world. How are you going to be able to speak? So when you see Notre Dame, right after the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals threw out Indiana's prohibition on same-sex marriage, this is obviously before Obergefell or leading up to Obergefell. And what does Notre Dame University rush to do to recognize in its policy same-sex marriage? Bronson would say that is a lack of understanding,
right,
of your institutional religious freedom and what you are actually supposed to propose to the world. In that regard, we're pretty weak right now. And also, and it's pretty evident that we don't understand the sort of, we have to come back and talk about it and learn about it again when we talk about religious freedom as it relates to schools, hospitals, et cetera, because all of these are now under threat. You think about it here locally. I live in Carmel. Carmel just passed a gender identity statute that applies to churches and their normal business activities. Now, nobody knows what that means. I've talked to different priests in Carmel trying to figure this out. They're talking to lawyers. But this is sort of the threat that we're under because of the idea of freedom of worship, or that it's something very individualistic, or I think also this idea you don't bring religion to the public square because it's meaningless and it's relative,
or
and
it's hurtful,
and it can't, or it's hurtful, and it can't possibly speak to anything that's real. Mm-hmm. And so, right, well, the only thing we really recognize
because
is real
no truth
would be like modern scientific thinking or something like that.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we've got to actually teach ourselves this again, and it's got to be something that we value and assert publicly with authority. If we don't do that, we can't depend on a court or an administrative branch saving us.
And that's another aspect of Bronson's thought, though, too, is that to preserve these things like freedom of religion, it's our action within these sort of intermediate institutions. It's our action within the hospitals, within the schools, that ultimately is going to carry the day. It's not necessarily these writs that are written from on high and coming down from the courts or coming down from the government. It's our interactivity as Catholics within the institutions that we live that's really meaningful and what's ultimately going to triumph.
No, that's absolutely right. And with Bronson going back to the relational person, so economics has to be largely free of the government, Bronson says, because we're all called to take care of ourselves and our families. Religion obviously grounds limited government because it's not the final and highest good of our existence. Religion is. And so we also must be free to teach and learn however we conceive of. Bronson is a huge defender of religious freedom. Whatever your conscience is informing you, you follow that. You have the right to follow that in America. So the middle institutions matter, but the middle institutions right now are incredibly weak in a way they certainly were not in Bronson's period. And so we're seeing this sort of wild oscillation, I think, between an individualism and a collectivism. And the consequences aren't just in these culture wars. This is also about, I think, the presidential campaign, the type of politics mm-hmm. we're getting, the type of shrillness, the type of polarization, precisely because the subjectivity of subjectivities, right? We have nothing, there's no common language uniting us or terms that we all seem to accept as Americans anymore. And so you get sort of, you get a loudmouth like Donald Trump, you get a park bench socialist like Bernie Sanders in this kind of environment, and it becomes incredibly difficult for someone to try and speak moderately and with humility about the problems we face. Those people look weak.
It seems like there's a fundamental, I agree with that. I think there's also another symptom, or I guess my diagnosis would also include a fundamental lack of commitment to objective truth. In other words, what moves the existence of an objective reality, objective truth, is what would allow people of goodwill, seekers of the truth, the title of your book, Seeking the Truth, is that that's what moves us past our own individual subjectivity, because we have that broader, deeper commitment to the truth of things. And so that's how you can build up these institutions. So I would say there's kind of a bankruptcy, this crisis of truth that others have coined. But the other thing I want to mention too is, you brought it up before, and it's something Pope Benedict the 16th had talked a lot about. He had one of his primary concerns, as I've read him, is around this liturgy. Orestes Bronson brings up this, and you mentioned it as well, Richard, this idea of the liturgy. It seems to me that there's a crisis around that too, a kind of thinning out of the liturgy. So you see this great, so take the American experiment, Catholicism in America. You see a great thinning out of what? Mass attendance, right? Mm-hmm. And that become mass increasingly seems to be manifesting itself at our participation as laity is becoming increasingly subjective, therefore what? Dispensable. And so you have great numbers falling away from the church.
Yeah, and I think we see that in virtually every, you know, Western liberal democracy over the past 50 years. It's certainly, you know, even in places like Quebec or Ireland, there's a lot that has to be said to account for that. I think within America, there was, you know, there's something quite strange. The stories that I've been told of thick community life within parishes and sort of Vatican II happens and you sort of get these changes immediately. And all of that, the way it's been explained to me is it just sort of went away. And then you sort of had now the professional laymen who run these parishes. We've got to recreate community. Or, you know, we've got mass has to be a way we create community. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, you had all this stuff to begin with, which is not to say that there weren't problems with the American church prior to Vatican II. And it's not to say that Vatican II is the changes have been bad, if there's anything wrong with the formal documents. But there's been an interpretation, right, that's been applied. I think what I see in the thinness of mass and liturgy, I think, is revealed in the way people just leave.
Yeah,
right. I think. Yeah. And what it says to me is this is sort of I think I participate in for me and now I'm gone. I mean, it's a lack of respect of formality, tradition, etc. All of these things.
I think it's a lack of a corporate of understanding of a sort of this corporate thing, or what, as you mentioned before, this sort of going back to what God is the highest good, is the good itself, and that God, we have an obligation here to serve Him, right, and to worship Him. And again, if it's all about me, if I've sinking in on myself, or I would say collapse on myself, or Aquinas, that incurvatus est, this sort of wrapping myself, curving in on myself, I think that's a big part of it. But guess what? We're going to run out of time again.
Too bad. That's too bad.
So here we go. So we've been spending the entire episode here talking with Richard Reinch of the Liberty Fund. You're an author. You're a scholar. You run the blog there. You've got a brand new book out, which I highly recommend. Get it on Amazon, other vendors. I'm sure your local Catholic bookstore will carry it. Seeking the Truth, an Orestes Bronson anthology. And you do podcasts, you do writing online. Where can we find, where can we follow your work?
Oh, thank you. LibertyLawSite.org is the online journal that I edit. And then I also host a podcast show there called Liberty Law Talk, which is something very similar to this in terms of great legal thinkers on contemporary topics.
Fantastic. Well, it's been great having you on the show. And pick up Orestes Bronson, any of his work. Start with this anthology by Richard Reinsch, because he's already done all the heavy lifting for you. Yes. He's made all the selections and put it all together. We're going to have you back very soon. I think we're talking about doing a show on Walker Percy. So all you listening to the Catholic Cave, Walker Percy, a great Catholic.
Maybe 2 hours for that show. Yeah.
At least. A marathon.
All right, and that wraps it up for this week on The Catholic Cave. Once again, we'd like to thank you for listening in. For Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle, and our guest, Richard Reinsch, I'm Kent Blanford. Thank you for listening to Catholic Radio Indy. Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.